Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And here I am. It's Peter Bregan, beginning with my ginger news flashes. Kind of a coordination of three recent reports, all of which tell the story of the struggle we have going on between the medicalization of childhood and the proper approach to children, which is to see them as needing us to give them more love, more attention, more education, more of what children need and have needed for probably millions of years. I know Homo sapiens were only, you know, who knows, 50 to 350,000 years in that range somewhere. Shows you what an exact science evolution is. But somewhere in that range, we really became ourselves. But I think going back even millions of years, human and human-like children have all needed the same thing: love, attention, limit setting, and introductions to how to master the world around them. They don't need labels. They don't need drugs. They don't need violence of any form inflicted on them. Well, there's a report out in Newsweek about autism therapy in the six-month-old babies. It was a very small study. It was like six, seven children. But the point of it is that this pilot study carried out at the University of California shows that if you intervene with kids 6 to 12 months old who are showing signs of becoming autistic, because you don't make a diagnosis then, they're withdrawn, they don't smile as much, they're not connecting as much, and so on, that if you do some simple interventions, now what are these, you know, what are these complicated things that these potentially autistic children need? Well, they teach the parents to set up a more organized and purposeful playtime, mealtime, everyday activities, and to improve their interactions with the children. And in this group, by 2 years, none of them could be identified as having autistic problems. Well, this is not a big surprise to me, yet when I talk about this gun, I run into a storm: resentment, autism's a disease, what are you saying about parents, and so on and so forth. What I'm saying is we're made of each other, folks. You know, we're born... talking with my guest about this. It was going to be really interesting and with some new and different stuff. I was talking about her on the phone about this, that, you know, we're born with a brain that's going to double its size in the first year. No other animals like that. And what does that mean? It means that you're born with practically a fetal brain, which then gets socialized for a year so that your brain is a social brain. We're made of each other. And it's social corrections that human beings need to thrive. Another study tested, drug-free therapy for childhood mental health problems. You know, what they did is they just taught parents better ways of relating with their kids. They put an earpiece in the parent, sat behind a mirror, a one-way mirror, and help them improve their relationships to their children. Parent training with wonderful results. Now, what's the reality here in America today? Well, another recent review shows that most U.S. kids who are getting ADHD meds, in fact, a huge majority, don't get anything else. 11% of boys is the estimate on ADHD drugs. It's of course, like 20% of the high school boys and 4% of the girls. And in 200 counties they looked at, less than 1 in 10 was getting, quote, therapy. Well, that's dreadful, but it's not as dreadful as the fact they don't even need therapy. They need better schooling. more appropriate education, more interesting, more education, exercise, as we've seen in some of my ginger news flashes, exercise before school. They need parent training for the parents. They need intact homes, so that's a hard one to correct. They need presence, much more fathers than these boys usually have. So here we are with in America, and really more and more around the world, we simply drug our kids when we know what they need. One study after another says kids need us. Not a lot more complicated than that, folks. Kids need us. They need us to be wise, intelligent, caring, informed in how we relate to them, whether we're their parents, their uncles, their grandfathers and mothers, whether we're their teachers, their ministers, their coaches. It's time to give up all the psychiatric nonsense. Just chuck it out the window. It really doesn't make any sense. And especially for our children, it's a ridiculous situation. Well, enough said. I also want to urge people to support Gary Null and his efforts with this wonderful station, PRN. You may have heard his ad beforehand, not really an ad, but a call for giving some support to PRN. And you can do it by going to PRN.org. Believe me, there aren't millions of stations eager to have the voice of Peter Bregan out there. There's very few indeed. There are some. As some many of you know, I actually talk to 6 million people every week or two on George Norrie's Coast to Coast. So I have a huge audience out there that I regularly address. But the kind of work I get to do, interviewing people in depth, I don't know another place I could do it other than on this wonderful station, PRN, FM, PRN.FM. Go there and give some support if you can. Well, my guest today, and I think this is going to be somewhat seamless as to what we discuss. Are you there, Gaia?
I am here. Hi.
Hi. You sound pretty good. Gaia, you can probably tell already, is from Great Britain, as are a number of my guests lately. I seem to, or more honestly, my wife, Ginger, does a lot in organizing the show, my producer, my director. Finds this marvelous people. My guest today is Gaia Marcus. It's G-A-I-A, like Gaia is usually spelled. And Marcus, M-A-R-C-U-S. And she's a senior researcher at the Royal Society for the Encouragement of Arts, Manufactures, and Commerce. This is apparently an old English organization. We'll call it the RSA. That's what they do. And it's basically a private charity. I imagine it gets some government funding. But in the case of her particular project, Gaia's project, she goes out there and all the other folks working on the project seek their own funding. And Gaia's working on a really interesting project. I'll give you a brief introduction to it, and as I understand, and then just sort of unleash her. But the project is the Social Mirror for Community. And it's a computer program that can be brought into a setting, for example, into a clinic, a British clinic. While people are waiting, they can work on this laptop and answer questions. And the guide that's with them and the program can come out with some prescriptions for social activities that might be beneficial. And she's actually researching this and seeing what effect it has on the physical and mental health of people, often elderly people. And she's doing other interesting things, too. Did I get that straight, Gaia?
That's really good. I think I'll take you with me to all meetings from now on, and you can explain my work far better than I do myself.
Well, you know, I would love to get to Great Britain. I've been working on it. I'm not sure it's going to happen soon. But, tell us about this program. Give us some philosophic, intellectual context for what you're doing, because it's a very important ideas as well as practical solutions.
Thank you. Hi. So I work for the RSA, which is this charity based in the UK. and we've been around for a very long time, close on 300 years. And the RSA has always been interested in how people make their ideas become reality. So I work for the Action Research Centre, which, as the name might suggest, does action and research projects. And I work within the Connected Communities team. Now, the Connected Communities team is very interested in how people connect to each other, so the social relationships that make up their lives, and what effect this has on people and their communities and the changes that they want to see in their local area and in their life. So I think a lot of the work that I do at the RSA can really be broken down into three key points. So one is looking at the effect on people of living in communities. We know that community can be good for you, it can be bad for you. The social relationships that you have will influence what you want to do, what you can do, whether you get sick, and if you get sick, whether you get better. And they're also really interested in how people can make small changes to their lives that make a very big impact going forward. I think often people think of change as a thunderstorm. You know, you get hit by lightning and something changes, whereas often it's as simple as changing one small practice and that having a knock-on effect for you and people around you. And then finally, the last thing I'm really interested in, especially as regards this project, is taking a whole population approach to health and well-being. So I think often we focus on groups that are seen to have specific problems, and obviously that's very important, but to take a preventive approach to people's health and well-being, I think we need whole population approaches to health, because we affect each other so much that there's no point dealing with one section of society if you're not taking the whole picture. And also, if we want to stop problems before they become real big problems, we need to be focusing upstream. You know, we need to focus on the kind of intervention that stops you becoming lonely, that stops you developing unhealthy habits, and not just dealing with things once they're an emergency.
Well, I think most of the folks listening here are going to agree with you, and also probably agree with you that modern urban living, in particular, doesn't provide a lot of opportunities for people who are, you know, economically struggling to have advantageous relationships in the community. Would you say that? And that's a part of what you're dealing with, isn't it? You're dealing with people who don't have economic advantages.
We do focus on areas that are maybe economically deprived. I think that the perils of urban living can be overstated. I think that actually cities provide a lot of the diversity that we need to do well. But yes, we are very much working on what happens when things don't work. So I think a lot of the global burden of ill health is down to factors that actually could do better with non-medical interventions. So we know that it's not really possible to talk about physical health without mental health. So we know that depression is set to become the global disease by 2030. We know that, for example, the demographic changes that people go through, your life stage, can often lead to loneliness and isolation in your health. So maybe older people living in cities and their social connections depleting, or their families moving away. You know, we know that dealing with an older person who's isolated shouldn't be a prescription, it shouldn't be a drug. We know that lifestyle factors can contribute to the global burden of disease more than, for example, genetic illnesses. So actually, we can make a big difference to global levels of well-being and health by focusing, say, on lifestyle and maybe psychosocial issues such as work-related stress, for example, which in Europe is seen to account for, I think something ridiculous, like 4% of our gross domestic product is lost in the costs associated with work-related stress in Europe. So I think we have this big amount of problems that are growing that actually need medical interventions that go beyond the solely medical. And then coupled with that, as you highlighted, is the effect of socioeconomic disadvantage on people's health. So in the UK, for example, people living in the poorest areas will live 7 years less on average than people living in more affluent areas. We know that the relationship between poverty and illness is so marked that you can also almost speak about a social gradient of health. So the better off you are, generally, the better your health will be. And it's worth highlighting that even in the UK, where we do have generally universal, freer access healthcare. So it's not just an artifact of maybe health systems where you need to pay for access, but across the board, you can really speak about a social capital of health almost. So your recovery, say, from breast cancer will depend on your socioeconomic status. And so when we know that we have so many physical, mental health illnesses and you know, things that stop people, essentially, that are linked to these factors that aren't medical in origin, but are about our social and cultural and economic context, then it has to make sense to focus on preventive measures. It has to make sense to see a social intervention on a par with a medical intervention, or at least dealing with another element. So this is the kind of work that we've been drawn into with the Social Mirror Project, which I have to stress isn't where we started. So the Social Mirror Project, which is a project that you described of being asked some questions with a computer and then being linked to activities in your local area, developed as an intervention as part of a longitudinal five-year study in 7 deprived areas in England, where we looked at the connections between people's social connections and their well-being. And in each site, we've been running local interventions that respond to the local data. And so the project you've been describing, Social Mirror, emerged in an area of the UK in Bristol, where we found that anxiety levels were far worse than the other very poor areas we've been working in. We found that there was a split almost between those who were kind of in the know, were doing things locally, and those who really felt quite isolated. And we also identified the reliance on the part of these people that weren't doing so well on health practitioners and community workers for their advice and emotional support. So on the one hand, it's great that people have found someone that gives them the emotional and the emotional support and advice, but it's obviously not really the role of a doctor to be your emotional pillar. And it got to the point where in the UK, we're almost seeing that people that maybe have lost other form of social support are actually presenting at the GP, at the general practitioner. So you'll get an inkling that someone isn't doing so well because they'll be turning up to the GP again and again. And actually, there is very little that the medical intervention can do for that. And so these social prescriptions, this linking people to activities in the local area, which can vary from arts to exercise to walking groups to lip reading classes, these have been seen to be quite a cost-effective actually intervention for people who are presenting multiple symptoms and aren't really responding to any treatment. And so that's what we did.
I'd like to sort of just draw this picture a little more for people to mull on.
Mm.
That human beings so need each other. We need connectivity for our sanity, for our physical health. We know that happy marriages and just plain marriages lead to longevity compared to living singly. We so need and crave social life, even though our intellectuals may want to deny it, even though our psychiatrists never even discuss it, even though we drug children without asking about their family lives. People depend on each other so much for what is good in the way of health and happiness. And it's so extreme, our need, that we will go to a practitioner, in this case in Great Britain, for 7 minutes, which is what Gaia told me is your typical visit there.
Yep.
It's probably about the same here. For 7 minutes of contact, they will go and sit in a waiting room. And in Great Britain, it's not like the U.S. You can really wait. Isn't that right? In the waiting room?
It's in the news at the moment. I've always been lucky, I have to say. In the area that we were working in, we actually went during drop-in, so people didn't have appointments. And even then, the average waiting time was only 45 minutes. But you'll be right that at the moment, it's a very big, hot news topic in the UK that waiting times are going up to see GPs.
Yeah. So folks will even do that, even though they don't socialize very much in the waiting room. They're just waiting for that few minutes with a father figure, basically, with a person of authority who will show them some kindness and some interest. We just need to take really seriously our needs. And it makes me think that that one of the things doctors could do would be to turn their waiting rooms into social areas. That would be interesting.
I think that would be fantastic.
Could be your next experiment.
You know, broader than this project, we're very much looking at how you create interventions in public spaces, given that at the moment we really have reduced resources in the Europe, especially in the UK, and how we run these projects that rely on social contact and social connections and community connections to help people do well in ways that aren't reliant, say, on practitioners. So in the research project that led to this intervention, with community researchers in 7 sites, we surveyed over 3,000 people who were asked about their social context, so who they knew, who they spend time with, who's important to them. They were asked about their levels of well-being, and this covered, say, life satisfaction, sense of worth, their mental well-being, their feelings about their area, their health satisfaction. So an immense amount of data, which possibly drove me a bit insane at the time, but we had this amazing picture of these 7 sites, where in each site we calculated the correlations between people's social connections, their community connections, and then how they were doing. And that we found, and it's a great, I mean, 3,000 door-to-door interviews is a great data set. So we found that if people didn't have someone that they felt close to, they would have lower life satisfaction and lower sense of worth in ways that were statistically significant. So it wasn't just chance. It was something that stood up to the numbers. We found that if people didn't have access to someone who'd give them practical help, so this might be someone who would put up a shelf or pop to the shops if you couldn't, or pick up a prescription for you, or, you know, these small social niceties that make life easier, we also found that if people didn't have that person in their life, they also wouldn't do as well. And then in each site, we'd find kind of interesting findings that related to the social context of that specific site. And so from that, we then are trying to make the more general case that communities do better when they have more control over their own resources and where people are able to make the most of the social connections around them. And so this is one of a range of social interventions that we've trialed based on these principles. Is it worth my painting a picture of how social mirror might feel if you were to take part in it?
I had a little technical difficulty here, but it sounds like things are going okay right now. I would like to emphasize a couple of things about what you're saying. For one thing, this is knowledge, and you're a historian. I didn't mention that Gaia's original, and again, we're talking with Gaia Marcus, that her original training was in history, and then she got an advanced degree in human rights. So she's coming at this from a different angle, and she's going to know what I'm about to say, which is that this kind of knowledge about the importance of social context, or just society, social relationships, is very old, and also the knowledge that poverty and economic deprivation is a huge factor in so-called mental illness. We had studies on this in the U.S. back in the 60s and even the 50s. I was reading studies about this in the 50s. So we're trying, it's a constant battle in modern society between the concept that human beings matter to each other and getting a prescription of one kind or another from an authority. So I just think this is an age-old and critical issue. The pendulum in medicine and psychopharmacology has just pushed things so much in the wrong direction. Now there's a little push backward. But nothing new is being said so much as we're coming back to better values. Does that make sense to you, Guy, or do you think, what's your view on that?
That's a long and loaded question.
You can take a little bit of time with it. We have 4 minutes before break.
So I think that what's happening, a lot of things are common sense. So the idea that social support is important for you, I think makes sense to people. But I think what we're trying to do now is not only prove the numbers case, so actually, you know, say, well, look, we've actually spoken to 200,000 people, as the Office of National Statistics does in the UK, and actually show that it isn't just common sense, but that the numbers add up. But also, I think we are trying to make the economic case for it. I think there's a danger where arguments that are seen as being soft, you know, they're about love and attachment and emotion and sociability, they're often seen as being kind of weak arguments. And I think now something that we're very focused on as well is actually really proving the economic case for it. You know, this isn't just a better way of doing it. It's a more efficient way of doing things. And it will make society work better. Because really at the moment, I think we've come to the end of the hegemony that functioned in our society, in Western societies, for the whole of the long 21st century. And we're trying to understand new ways of conceptualizing how people should relate to each other and how people relate to the state. And something that I love about the Social Mirror Project is that we are using these new technologies. So we're using algorithms and computers and things that often, I think, maligned in the press as deconnecting people to reconnect them to what matters, which is being in their own community. So I think we're at quite a nice balancing point in how we understand society. And I find it quite exciting.
Well, I in no way was minimizing what you're doing. I probably have some ambivalence to some part of it, calling it prescriptions, for example. Why buy that model? But I can see why you'll get more funding for that model. And so I'm patient and forgiving about it. And I think what you're doing is very, very, very important. Now, do you have follow-ups? And again, folks, just to get the picture, which is these prescriptions are given from the computer with the help of the assistant for things in the community that will be worthwhile, useful, health-giving, happiness-inducing for the individual. And I'm sure you've been talking about, but I haven't quite got the data. I know it's not as extensive as you want on the follow-ups.
One of the big problems with social prescriptions in the UK at the moment is that people know they're good, but they can't prove it. So something that was very key for us with Social Mirror was ensuring that there was baseline data at the beginning. So in order for someone to be issued with a prescription, they need to have answered questions about their well-being and their social connections and their feelings of health and their service use. So when someone actually first interacts with the system collects data about them. And then that allows us to go back to people and see what changed. And so we've been conducting evaluations where we go back to people. We've both been collecting numbers and we've been collecting stories.
Gaia, let me hold you there. When we come back, we will get into talking about the data. What is she finding?
Fantastic.
Can she really show this stuff works? Okay?
See you after the break.
We can, well, we'll talk during the break, hopefully, and let's go to the music, Giselle. And this is Dr. Peter Breggin, my guest, Gaia Marcus, G-A-I-A, Gaia.
Hi.
Like the earth. What?
Hi, yes, Gaia, like
yes.
The earth.
and her last name is Marcus, M-A-R-C-U-S, and she's a senior researcher at an ancient British charitable society called the RSA, going back before the Constitution and the Revolution here in America. And we're talking about how much the social context, relationships, influence people in their physical health, as well as obviously in their mental health, and about her project that she's been working on, the Social Mirror for Community, where they use computer work and an assistant to kind of develop a prescription for what this person who's answering the questions might really need and find in their community. Before that, I wanted to emphasize that this is not a matter just, and Gaia is by no means suggesting it is just for the economically deprived. But I want to emphasize that increasingly I see in my work and my practice and my living life that wealth, economic security, fame, fortune can bring a sense of satisfaction and security, but they don't bring happiness, and they don't even prevent despair. What human beings most need is fulfilling personal relationships. If you've got those, you're going to be happy living on a relatively small income in relatively unstable times. If you have that, you have the essence of what really brings happiness. And I remember reading Aristotle in high school, and he was, I think it was Aristotle, he was commenting on the old women babbling at the well and puzzling over what made them happy. And of course, what made them happy was their relationships. They're taking care of their families at the well. They're getting water. They're washing clothes. They're visiting with each other. Human beings and relationships are what matter. And we're looking at ways to approach that. And with that, I give the mic back to you, Guy.
Thank you very much. So you left me just before the break with the million-dollar question, which is, does it work? What does the data say? What is the effect of the intervention? So I thought I would take a step back and just give people a proper idea of what the intervention actually is, what it feels like, and then go into the results of the study. So I'm sure everyone will have memories of having done magazine quizzes. I'm sure it's not just a human thing. I'm sure we all have done magazine quizzes in the past where you answer a series of questions, you add up your answers, and the magazine will tell you that you're person A, you are energetic and excitable, or you're person B, you are calm and demure, etc. And Social Mirror does something very similar, only it does the adding up for you. So you might be waiting in the doctor's surgery to see the doctor. You might be in a community center. You might even be, we've done this, in a shopping center. And someone will come up to you and explain that we're doing a study into what works for people in local communities, what helps people do well in those communities. Would you be interested to take part? It'll only take 10 minutes, and you might receive a suggestion for something fun or interesting to do locally. So if you haven't run away by then, you'll be asked a series of questions about how you feel, the people who are important to you, if you feel part of the community. And this is quite nice because if you mention, say, a partner or a friend or someone from your family, we actually drag that person onto the screen. So you get a kind of physical representation of your social connection so you can see it and you can move those social connections around. We'll then ask you about your interests. And then a couple of questions that are just important in terms of thinking what activities might be appropriate. So how's your mobility? You know, we're not going to recommend tango to someone who can't walk. How's your hearing? All these kind of questions so that we're not recommending something inappropriate. The tool then adds everything up and it will feed back on your answers. So it'll say, hey, well done, 5 out of 5. Your well-being looks great. Or it might say, oh, looks like you might need to feel a bit more part of your community. Have you considered doing this thing? And then I'll give you a series of local activities and groups that could be useful given your answers. So an elderly gentleman, let's call him Steve, who came in and he'd just become retired. So that's often a bit of a life shock for people, stopping working. So he's recently retired, quite isolated. He didn't tell us at the time, but he'd also been drinking regularly, maybe more heavily than he should have done. And he was quite interested in being active. And so he puts his answers in, and the tool suggests walking groups. So I email him. I put him in touch with a local walking group. 2 months later, I email him asking, hey, how's it going? You know, are you doing the group? Did it work for you? And he comes back to me saying, thank you so much. I've been going to this walking group for 5 weeks, and I've lost 9 pounds. And so this is kind of what it feels like in practice. So over the course of the project, we about 150 people did this process over the course of a year. Of those people, we have data for 110 people, because whenever you do a new technical project, you find that there are gremlins hiding in the system that no one knew about. And then we managed to follow up in numbers with about 45 people, and then we did in-depth interviews with another 10 people. So we've got quite a good picture of what's happening. So the people that did Social Mirror, bear in mind these are general population that just happens to be going to the GPs. They're not necessarily ill or lonely or sad. Of these people, 13%, so that's almost 1 in 6, almost 1 in 6 of the people that we spoke to and recommended an activity went and did these activities. So this could be lip reading classes, it could be walking groups, it could be activities for young children. But yeah, we find that of the general population people that we speak to, almost 1 in 6 go on to do these activities. We then found that 77% overall, so that's 8 out of every 10 people almost, said that Social Mirror made a difference in their life. So that could be the people going to the activities, it could be feeling more part of your community, it could be actually just feeling reassured by the knowledge that there are good things happening around you. And then we found that there was this quarter for whom Social Mirror didn't change much. Some of these people, I think, had higher needs than the project could serve. And others were just doing well. Not everyone needs to do something. So that's kind of what the data is looking like. And we're now working with researchers from the LSE, the London School of Economics, to understand whether there were any cost effects. Is our data good enough to show that actually there was a change in people's service use? We don't know that yet. We're still tossing that one up. But that's really the next step. It's saying, okay, so people are doing better. We know that people that did the prescription felt a lot better about their lives. But actually, did that change how often they went to the GP? Did that change if they were going to A&E, to accident emergency, to ER, sorry? You know, and that's, I think, really when you start winning the argument. If you can start showing that by linking people to social and community activities, they're actually using medical resources less, then you start being able to change the conversation around what is and what isn't a medical intervention.
Do you have any inkling from the data yet?
Yeah, so the people that went to the projects showed far higher community scores, and it looks like they were using general practitioners less. But on a short project, you always have to be quite careful because
I didn't hear that, the word, Gaia. How much higher, what scores?
Sense of community.
Oh, okay.
So their feeling of being part of something that is a community was, I think, about 30% higher. So we are seeing data that does suggest that this is having an impact on people's lives and it is improving their well-being. And this is in line with a lot of data from other projects that does show that doing these projects does increase people's emotional well-being, cognitive skills even, social support. And what is still inconclusive in a lot of projects is actually seeing whether in the long run this does lead to reduced medical costs. And I think one of the main reasons for that is that you need longer studies. You know, you can't necessarily affect an enormous change in someone's life in 6 months. You know, change will take time to trickle through. So one young woman that I spoke to, and it's very dear to my heart because she was my age, and I actually did the interview with her because I happened to be in town when she was in the doctor's surgery. So I remember speaking to her. It was right at the beginning of the project. And she was doing fine by any in any medical sense. She'd moved to the area recently for her partner, and she was lonely. But she kind of decided that was possibly the choice she'd made. She'd chosen to move to this area for her partner and for their children. And yes, she was lonely, but apart from that, everything was fine. And so she wouldn't necessarily have seen the need to change something. Talking with me, the tool then suggests that she does activity because the tool picks up on the fact that she is lonely. And she ends up going to activities for her kids. And then through doing those activities, she then goes to activities for herself. Now, 1 year down the line isn't enough time really to prove this. But you can imagine someone who is very lonely, that's really only living through the contacts of their partner and of their children. You know, in 5-10 years' time, you could be talking about depression. You could be, you know, you'd be talking about a range of mental and physical health problems that do stem from the fact that someone isn't quite feeling fulfilled and connected where they are. And so I think we do need longer-term studies that follow people for longer periods of time. We're talking decades. To really understand the impact of linking them into community prescriptions instead of always dealing with problems once they're an A&E problem, once they're an emergency room problem.
Yeah, when I was in college, Guy, a friend of mine, my first year, said, Peter, you're sitting around your bottom studying all the time. Come on out and volunteer at the state hospital, the state mental hospital. And it changed my whole life. That introduction into an aspect of the community, and the great needs I saw, and the possibility that I might contribute something, was just completely changed my life. And I suspect that eventually, if you do this enough, you'll be actually changing some lives as people get introduced into meaningful things in the community.
People say that already.
Well, tell us about that.
So it's quite humbling, actually, because I feel that I have lived quite a short life to change anyone else's, to be honest. But we have had people saying that chance conversation in the GP surgery has changed everything. And obviously, it is a case of just someone nudging you along a path that maybe you were ready to go down. I don't believe that someone suggesting an activity is enough if you really don't want to change anything. So we had someone who said, I can't say enough about it because it has changed my life. If I hadn't done it, I wouldn't have known about these walking groups. After I retired, I felt like a refugee. 3 days a week, I didn't get out of the flat. I didn't leave the apartment in American. I've now lost the stone and weight. I can talk to people quite freely, which I didn't before. I've stopped drinking alcohol. I don't need it to help me sleep as the walks tire me out. And the young woman we were talking about earlier said, social media has made a massive impact in my life because when I moved here, I had nobody and nothing. Going to groups through social media started the ball rolling. I've been going to groups for my children and for myself. I've made friends and I know the area better. My life is a lot happier and more content now, and I don't feel so lonely. And these, you know...
I'm not surprised. I think that's marvelous. Are there follow-ups, or is it just... setting aside the research follow-ups, do you follow up to give encouragement or further direction, or is it the one-time-only experience?
Currently, no. So there's one gentleman that I've been calling periodically, mainly because he doesn't seem to mind me calling every so often. And every time I speak to him, he's one step closer to going to a social prescription, so I'm persisting. But no, I think within the scope of the project... it was very much that we'd have the baseline data and then a 1 month follow-up and then where appropriate 6 months. And because of the way the project worked out with immeasurable technical delays, that didn't happen as much. I think if I were to redesign the project, if this work becomes something that more people can use, I'd actually want this to be a personal application that people would even have on their phones. And it would be this checking in with people, because actually, maybe when we first spoke to you, you're doing fine, and then a month later you have a bereavement, for example. You know, there should be a mechanism that checks in with people every so often to make sure that they're still doing fine. Because someone can be living a completely healthy life and then one thing happens that will just change everything. And so I think it would be great, and my vision for it would be that this would just be a way of checking in with people. How are you doing? Do you feel connected to people? How's your well-being? You know, have you seen someone this week? And if people say no, then they can link to something. And really, my vision would be that if you went to the post office, someone could ask you this. And if you were ordering shopping online and they noticed, you know, the system noticed that you always buy a meal for one, it could ask you this. I really think that this kind of checking in should be as integrated into our lives as possible, and that new technology should be used to connect people back into their physical localities.
Well, I'm not sure I want to go online to order a book on Darwin and be asked how my personal relationships are. But
there has to be a time and place, I suppose.
Now, you quoted a figure that one out of six people who took the test followed up. Did you consider that a good or a poor result? I have no idea.
That's a very good question. It was just under, so 13, so just under one in six. I actually think it's a brilliant result, and I think that if we did it at a larger scale, that number would go down. You know, if you can imagine, people that are just living their daily lives, why are you special enough to be able to tell them what to do? So I think that actually one in six general population going from not doing activities to doing activities is a really good result. People disagree. I think this is actually why I make the case for general population approaches to health. It is a relatively low-cost intervention. So even if it only reaches 1 out of 100 of each person, you're still making a massive impact on people's lives. And I think that's a really important thing. I think there is a time and place for high-cost, focused interventions that change one person's life at a time. But there's also a time and place, and in terms of prevention, I think it's incredibly important that we have these general screening, whole population approaches to health, where we can find problems before they're big problems. So yeah, I actually stand by the one in six saying it's quite good. But yes, we have had people think otherwise.
I myself, and I won't emphasize it any further, but as many of my listeners know, I'm terrified of the government getting anywhere near my personal life or the personal lives of people. I just need to put that caveat in. You've got one in six people following up. In a given waiting room, how many people would reject or accept the invitation? Do you know that?
Oh, I see, to actually do the survey itself. That's a really good question. My hunch is that it completely depends on the person with the tool.
Sure it does, yes.
Some people can talk anyone into doing anything and others can't. I really don't have a figure for you. It would depend very much also on how busy the practice was. We found if the practice was quite empty, it was actually very hard to get people to do the survey. I think because, you know, they might maybe felt quite exposed. Whereas if the practice is quite busy, it was actually quite easy to get people to do it. And you often find there's a kind of pass-it-on effect. So if one person says no, everyone says no. And if one person says yes, everyone says yes, is what we tend to find. So no, I can't really give you a figure for that. But no, that's a very good point, because obviously by having to speak to a person, so by having to do it through the volunteer, there are benefits in that they're talking you through the process and various other things, but you do have the massive drawback that someone maybe with social anxiety or somebody that just isn't comfortable talking to strangers won't do the system. So I think, in a way, we've proved that the metaphor works. We've proved that the idea of you giving some answers, the system crunching those answers based on our knowledge of well-being science and network analysis, giving you suggestions, and then you having a conversation with that individual as to whether they want to do their activities or not, that works. And what we need to be looking at now is how that system could be used by other people. So how that interaction could be used in as many situations as possible. So one thing to look at is actually for clinicians. So you mentioned this earlier about a child who's not doing well and no one asks about their family. And I think this is a problem we have across the health and social care systems. It's not as usual as it should be to ask somebody about their social context when you are prescribing them something. So that can go from someone who has severe anxiety issues who has a limp, and no one's asked them in 20 years about the limp and whether that limp is affecting their confidence. It could just be that. It can be assuming that an older person who is fragile should be put into a care home when actually there is someone at home that could look after them, and actually that would help them stay in there. You know, so that there are so many cases where understanding the social context of someone will help them do better and help get to the root of problems. And so you can imagine a modified version of this social mirror tool that represents people's social connections in ways that both the practitioner and the individual can see and play around with could be really useful in a variety of non-clinical and clinical settings.
You know, in the old days in the U.S., your family doctor would know you and your children, and he could say, you know, how's so-and-so doing? What are you doing to take care of yourself? And I think we really are we've lost that. We've virtually lost it, not only in your system, but in ours as well. Because the ideal, in some ways, would be if the doctor himself did it, if he or she had the time.
We tried. We did try, but
tell me about that.
Not
that's,
many minutes
that sounds,
to do it.
That sounds interesting. Tell me about that. We have about we have a few minutes left.
Both minutes. One of the key problems with social prescribing in the UK at the moment is GP take up. So general practitioner take up is a big problem. They're incredibly busy. They don't have much time, and a lot of projects have found the same thing. It is high on impossible to ask practitioners to ask these questions during their seven-minute appointments for obvious reasons. But also, and this wasn't in our project, but in other projects, they found that general practitioners aren't great at prescribing people to the project. So I think, again, there is the need to prove that this does have a tangible effect on people's costs, essentially, because that is, general practitioners are businesses in the UK, so you need to prove that there is actually a cost benefit to these interventions, I think, before practitioners will start using them. But that is, you know, the kind of beginning of the battle that we're on.
Explain that, I don't know if that can be done in 2.5 minutes or so. Can you explain that idea that within a socialized medicine system, each practitioner is his own business and has to struggle with cost effectiveness? Can you describe that? Is that too much for a minute and a half?
I think that's too much for a minute and a half, but that is it in a nutshell. So, for example, if I go to a GP and I get a prescription for even like gluten-free bread, I can't eat gluten, that prescription has a certain cost to me. So the blanket cost of prescriptions is, I would say £7, I could be wrong, so about $14, $15. For anything, but the practitioner pays for that as well. So there's quite a complicated system with accounting. I don't feel qualified to say anything beyond that, I'm afraid.
Yeah. Okay.
Especially not in our last minute. But yes, cost issues are a big issue within a socialized medical system as well, because the system is free at the point of access, but it's definitely not free.
We're drawing to a close. My guest.
Yeah.
Gaia Marcus from the Royal Society for the Encouragement of Arts, Manufacture, and Commerce in Great Britain. How do people get in touch with you?
Email or Twitter.
Whatever you want to give folks.
So email is gaia.marcus@rsa.org.uk. And Twitter is LaGaia, so that's LA_GAIA. And to be honest, there aren't that many. There are no other Gaia Marcuses in the world.
Yeah, I think, folks, just
go if you Google me, you'll find me.
Google Gaia Marcus, and you will learn a lot about a wonderful new experimental approach to helping people find people and activities. If there is one motto to my life as I grow older, it's about people loving each other and taking care of each other. Thanks for listening to the show. And Gaia, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.